Hi, everybody. Very, very happy to be here. I was many times in CCC, last time with, previous time with David Graeber. So David Graeber, for somebody who doesn't know, was a very influential anthropologist. He wrote many books, 5,000 Years of Death, Bushy Jobs, Pirate Enlightenment, and they were translated to more than 40 languages. His major legacy, how he called it himself, was the colonization of the Enlightenment, and it seems right to us to place his institute, an archive, in the country of the Global South, the region that was experienced a dark side of Enlightenment. So I will, in this talk, I will talk about how Museum of Care and David Graeber Institute was born and what we are doing now, and then we will invite you to join us. So a little bit about David's ideas. So he come with his writings in a way arguing with quite influential thinkers of his time. I'm very interested in his conversations or thought about Levi-Strauss, who described the social life as a system of fixed relationship and codes that left little room for human subjectivity. Levi-Strauss also was connected to cybernetics, and I just heard talk here making this connection that is very interesting. So David was following his teacher, Terence Turner, and Lev Vygotsky, emphasizing on learning and development through social interaction. And he was drawn to more generative ways of thinking, focus on struggle in a way, in ways people actively make and remake their world. That is much more closer to Noam Chomsky ideas. So against the model that saw society primarily as something to be managed, more like a ways to explore what people actually do, imagine, and create together. In this approach, let's shape the foundation of Museum of Care. So Museum of Care was born out of Carnival. So when David died, instead of funeral, we created a carnival, and this is a places in the world where it take part. So it was hundreds of places, many, many. So this is a carnival in London, but it also was a carnival in New Zealand, in Berlin, in Zuccotti Park, in New York, all around the world. And since that time, carnival become annual. This is the last one in London, 2025. The next one will be in Nairobi in Kibera Art District in Kenya. So it's very important, the idea of carnival, since David took to Madagascar, where he spent 2 years, only two books, one Dostoevsky and another Mikhail Bakhtin, because also the ideas of Bakhtin about what is human nature is very similar to David's, so he understands humans as something that is becoming and not fixed. And that's, extremely important. So after that, we set up Museum of Care and David Graeber Institute based on the connections that happens during Carnival. So we're doing art exhibitions. This is the last one called Make Carnival Not War, that was set up very close to the Abbey Road where Beatles cross the road, and it's original posters with 18 artists who designed different ideas of what carnival could be. We are going to use this in the costumes and transparency in Nairobi as well. So the alternative ideas of museums also come up from our collection of the essay that David and I wrote called Another Art World, that described museums, contemporary museums, a very important part of financial capitalism that actually produce and reproduce value system that emphasize their individual achievement of a specific artist or specific cultures over the others, and also creates a system of knowledge reproduction that ideally we need to replace or dismantle. So, and that's how the idea of Museum of Care, which is, that's what we're trying to do. And one of the important things for the museum, as we are, as David was saying, human beings are ritual-created creatures. So we need symbols and rituals. That's why Carnival. But another idea is to make museums in the abandoned ships. So this is a real one, a boat, quite big, that we found in the shores of St. Vincent. It's a Caribbean island where we did a lot of work for the last 2.5 years. So apparently there is 2,500 abandoned ships in the Maritime Foundation database. They basically buildings with rooms and doors, and at the same time they're polluting the ocean, so it's a toxic waste. Why is it a great idea? Is because you create a museum that anybody can copy. So it's a different model than the model of contemporary museums that based on preventing copying, on uniqueness of collection, of preserving artifacts over the reproduction. So so here's like our idea is to create the collection in a museum that potentially anybody can come and copy and take with them. Something very useful for reproduction of the human life and not the reproduction of abstract culture or objects. So we have in our museum a 3D printer, of course, and it's self-replicated 3D printer, RepRap, and spirulina and other open source food. So we started to work in St. Vincent, actually in a prison, and that's also very important because prison is a non-commercial space. They don't need to sell anything. But it's also have people who want to learn and have a lot of free time. So this is our last visit in this prison where we installed 3D printer and also a machine that's shredding plastic because for all the Caribbean island, one of the bigger problem is plastic trash. So they can use this trash to create material for 3D printer, print stuff from that. And then we also organized for them how to, a foundation who came with us organized for them where to deliver this stuff. They will print something for the blind people to use as educational material. And so this is our, this prison is an example of the node where we will try to bring more and more stuff. We're also building spirulina farm there. One of this inmate, this guy actually is an architect, so he helped us come up with the idea of the playground that Alistair will talk later on. And so before I talk to about, I give to Alistair, I want to talk about poetic and bureaucratic technologies. And that's also a very important point for David. So he coined this term about poetic technology, technologist. So it's building on this generative open model because for the survival, people also, we not only need food and shelter and water, we also need freedom. So this project, Survival Kit Collection, it's not, we don't understand it's something that is NGO-like project where we know what we're going to bring people and we will save them from something. So that's more like a project with belief that reproduction of human life is also based on play. And that's very different from bureaucratic technologies that is born from the worldview that and absolutely certain they will figure out everything. They already figure out how the things should work and how to save humanity. So it's very close to the structuralism and Levi-Strauss ideas. So it's a kind of utopian thinking, the same solutionism many people will recognize from today's techno-optimist vision, utopia that literally means place that don't exist, and maybe we're lucky that it didn't exist, because I just want to give one quote from one of the iconic utopias, Tommaso Campanella book, City of the Sun, 1602. In this book, society is organized so that, for example, marriages are arranged by the state. On certain days, everyone walk around naked, so a council of elders can decide which sexual organs fit together the best. Wives and children are held in common. Weaker or less intelligent children are expelled from the city. So, yeah, I bet it's anybody think it's a heaven. But in a way, strangely enough, that utopian thinking is also keep repeating in many other current, very contemporary ideas. If we talk about Peter Thiel or Alex Karp, who also trying to design system that will make us all happy and safe. I think we don't have enough time, so now I have to probably give place to Alistair to talk about one of our project of survival kit collections, that is a playground, and then connected to the university.
Cool, yeah.
There we go. Hi, everyone. Let me switch. Do you know where you had the... Thanks, me.
Okay.
A bit about me, I suppose I should start. I'm a designer. I trained originally as an architect, although I'm not an architect anymore. I'm now the founder of a small nonprofit organization called Open Systems Lab, working on, if you like, design... of systems. So most of the time I'm working on things like this. This is WikiHouse. It's an open source modular building system for zero carbon buildings. Projects like this, which is trying to kind of rewire the our rent extracting property systems, which is the driver of so many of our housing crises, etc. And actually also building some really interesting open source technology for planning authorities, which is kind of weirdly giving them the tools to kind of hack their own bureaucracy in a way. This is a bit of a departure, right? So Nika came to me and told me about this project about the visual assembly project. And on one level, it's a pure hardware question, but I want to, if you'll indulge me, I just want to take a bit of a loop into the back to kind of first principles and ask myself, well, why? What is this and why is it important? And I guess with, you know, it's really about education, right? And I'm specifically picking on universities here, but of course, it goes far further than that. And there's a first kind of obvious point here, which, you know, we don't have time to go here, but I'm not even going to try and get into the many and corrupted functions of education, which are infinitely broader than the narrow description we're usually catered for, which is education is essentially a form of labor market supply, right? We know that education and learning are infinitely more important than that, not just for how we develop knowledge as a society, but also, of course, hope, individual hope, right? Like education is fundamentally how, as I said here, how society says you're allowed to start again. And if you strip that away, society starts to look like something very, very depressing and very, very dangerous. It's not going to be news to anyone here that the current educational further education infrastructure is in trouble, right? It's not going great. And you can broadly summarize it as this, right? Which is the cost of higher education is going up and up, and the value is the marginal value is going down. Broadly, I think a pretty good comparison can be made here from the great design sage Terry Pratchett on his observations on religion, which is basically all religions start with a god, and around it they grow a priesthood and rituals and ceremonies and buildings. And at some point during this process, the god dies, but everyone's too busy to notice. And I think exactly the same has broadly happened to it's a pretty familiar pattern of institutional rise and decay in these like really originally fantastic ideas of how can you make these knowledge-rich institutions. And so essentially we have this weird late stage slow decline or potential collapse of some of these systems where they're being held up as this sort of shell, but actually that shell looks increasingly hollow in terms of, you know, it's giving people degrees that are of less and less value and so forth. And to kind of jump into that, I've picked here on the UK, not because that the UK is the only place where this is happening, but the UK has the dubious medal of almost being at the worst end of lots of these problems, right? When it comes to housing and universities and things like that. And if this is kind of the broad picture of where UK universities are getting their income from, the big chunk of it from, and you can actually see how this kind of mining is taking place. So we've got a mix of fees, international fees, and then rents and incomes, right? So if we just jump in on just the fees, in the UK especially, that's driven by this new system of debt. So now the typical student graduating from the UK universities is burdened with £53,000 of debt upon graduation. That's before they can even think about owning a home or anything like that. And we know, like, quite aside from that, that, like, if you think through the psychological impact that that has on people, not just the debt itself, but the choices it then drives people to make, it speaks to this common theme of declining institutions where effectively at some point, rather like Terry Pratchett's observation, the institution starts to do exactly the opposite of what it was originally set out to do. So it was meant to be a liberating, emancipatory sort of thing, and it ends up like burdening people with fear and massively limiting their futures and driving people towards financial outcomes. Another symptom of this, obviously, is in the UK, dependence on international students. Not that teaching international students isn't a great thing to do, but of course the reason they're simply doing this is just as a way to let anybody in who'll bring the money. So propping up these systems. This is one of the things that blew my mind, though, is that all of those costs are topped up to about £52 billion per year. But if you actually look at who's making the big income from universities, UK universities today, it's actually not even universities, it's actually landlords. So the amount of landlords by 2028, so this is going to get bigger and bigger, is that private landlords are actually making almost double the amount of money that universities are from further education, right? So there's this deep system of entrenchment, capture and rent extraction, and clearly this is going to break. And how do we know it's going to break? Because it always breaks, right? History tells us it always breaks. So through in different ways, and there's lots of really fascinating things, and David wrote, like, you know, in-depth, really fascinating, brilliant things about some of these examples, from medieval monasteries, which obviously in England, which broke in a very extremely sudden destructive way in the form of the Reformation. The Imperial Chinese examination system was kind of reformed almost overnight, versus the more common form of decay is something much slower. So we can see these kind of pretty common patterns of systems in their ascendancy and then systems in their decline phase, where you see rent seeking, focus on processes over outcomes, the emergence of a priesthood and so forth. Now, the exciting thing about this, that's the kind of depressing bit, the exciting thing about this is, of course, as David so brilliantly put it, that the ultimate hidden truth of the world is we can remake it. This is a system that can be remade. And not only that, but this system is so bad that it's massively disruptible, right, from really lots and lots of angles. Because people are getting such a bad deal and more people are going to start voting with their feet. So this is kind of a simplistic way to kind of, that I kind of basically see the world, is in terms of old systems, people increasingly will vote with their feet of leaving the old system and joining a new one. And in fact, the almost it's very likely that the failure mode won't be sudden or catastrophic. Universities like MIT and Cambridge and Oxford, they're not going anywhere. They're going to be around. They've been around for a long time, right? But the rest of this bigger system is going to decline very slowly, and some other new set of practices can and must come and start developing that. So we can begin to imagine, and that's what exactly what I think visual assemblies are beginning to do, what would be the dynamics of that, right? So we know what broadly, we're all familiar with the kind of phases of decline of old systems, right? But actually, what are the phases of emergence of new interesting practices, new organizing logics or conceptions of what education could look like? Now, we don't have time to go through these. I just went on a thought meander prompted by this invitation to kind of really think about this. All of you, I'm sure, will have lots of richer thoughts on this. But what are the fundamentally different organizational logics of this? The idea that you have this big upfront cost, that education is this time box 3 or 4 years, feels really obsolete versus the idea of something that's lifelong, that's episodic, that you can jump into in and out of. The idea of moving from something which you stuck up with, a huge debt-driven model, towards something which is about low risk and experimentation and other forms of exchange. Also then into the knowledge models themselves. If, as I'm sure many of you are kind of participants in open source communities, you are already familiar with a bunch of things that have been around for decades, like Git, and forms of open collaboration and knowledge management and knowledge versioning that these institutions still have, like, right. So there's a lot of dynamics here that we can begin to imagine. It's really easy, actually, to imagine better other ways that are doing this. Now, particularly, I was interested, and I guess this is where we come back to, is like, well, what's the infrastructure of this? And I think this, what's particularly interesting about this is when we move away from this idea of expensive campus buildings that cost an absolute living fortune, where can we see some of these things beginning to emerge? And I think there's two particular kind of dynamics or typologies that are really interesting. So one, I think, is going back to that crazy thing about rent, right? That's a really interesting thing. Whereas if you can disrupt that space and create learning places where people are not just in one place, but actually residentially in different places, you can essentially take the main living cost off the table. So I'm seeing more and more groups doing various versions of finding old abandoned farm buildings or whatever it is in different places where the economy is struggling, and creating different forms of mini institution that you don't go and live there all year round, but actually you're part of. These are kind of network communities. So I think that kind of residential component is really very a kind of really interesting aspect. But the other thing is then, and there's you know other examples of this, like Free Home University, which Aniko told me about just this morning. But also this idea, which Nick is exploring, which is about actually existing shared spaces in cities. Instead of going to all the trouble, should we switch back to your slides here, Nick? Going to all the trouble of sort of building these huge white elephant university buildings. Oh no, yeah, it did work. Actually, how could we approach the basic infrastructure of using existing shared spaces? Now, some of these might literally be existing buildings, right? So instead of making a music school, you already will see stuff that's co-locating with music shops, for example, which would otherwise not be commercially viable on their own. So the intertwining of education with the rest of life is really, really interesting. But also, like just having space to gather, space that's demarcated, maybe spaces with certain levels of shelter. So we saw when Nick has started talking about this, and they started prototyping things. Like my first thought, and Gabriella, an engineer who I work with, our first thought was like, what are the basic design principles for something like this? Learning from work we've done on other open source hardware stuff like WikiHow. So it's got to be structures that are simple to build, that are very, very that are modular, so you don't have big upfront costs. The thing can respond to how much money you have and then grow if it has activity. It can respond to people, essentially kind of making buildings more like good software, I should say. Also, the ability to share it as code. Now, in projects like WikiHouse, we do that in a very literal way. We share cutting files into digital fabrication machines. But actually, there's other ways of doing that. So even topology of rope, knots of a rope. Almost everybody has rope, access to some form of rope, for example. So that is something that can be shared in a replicable kind of way. So this is what we've sort of begun to do. And this is a kind of open source set of ideas to be tested and iterated. In other words, definitely wrong. But this is a kind of idea which is actually when we and you have had organizations, institutions come forward and say, well, actually, we've got this space. You could do some of this stuff. We'd be perfectly happy for people to do stuff here because, by the way, we're in a massive system of decline here. So actually, when people turn up, you know, so the idea here of using masts and posts to deal with the difficult compression bit of buildings instead of all the kind of complex bits of columns and floors that have to be signed off, etc., and go through all that kind of bureaucratic complexity. What this means is you can then use tension structures connected to that to make something that's very adaptive, very, very agile, whether it's just a tent or some shade or much more kind of develop structures where you can actually sit, build seating spaces, or even inhabitable enclosures, temporary homes, etc., etc. So, but the idea of being this is a public. It's kind of like public. Instead of thinking of it like a building, it's more like thinking of it as commons, public space with infrastructure, with kit that you can actually do that. And actually, weirdly, by treating it as more like art or more like playground, it sits outside of the financial and regulatory systems that would normally be brought to a building, whilst potentially offering, you know, as many as 80% of the benefits that an institutional building or a building would give you. Anyway, I'll hand back to you, Nika.
Final 3 minutes.
Yeah, and this is the idea of visual assembly that we wanted to put in the middle of the playground. Visual assembly is the idea that David and I come up together because I'm not a native speaker, and it was just post-occupied time when everything was about assembly, and I just realized, so who is actually going to convince other people in the assembly, the native speakers, the educated, the people who train to be a public speakers? And that's not migrants, not kids, not probably various groups of people, but they can do other ways of thinking. For example, they can draw together. So this is a place in Nairobi Central Library that is the biggest library in Africa that proposed us to put huge sticker with visual assembly about playground where kids can draw and redraw. But also they propose us a real space in front of the library where we can actually build a playground. So playground in this case, a very good metaphor, the same as an abandoned ship, because playgrounds are multi-generational, they are always in the public spaces, and the playground is the idea of the playground is there is no one best playground. It's supposed to be many of them. Crucially important that it will be like a network of the playground. And Alistair and I wanted to invite you to think about educational spaces the same way as we think about playgrounds. So we will have a visual assembly today at 5:30, and Cory Doctor also going to join us. So please come to discuss a future university that we hope to build Zanzibar or Nairobi. We actually want to plan a real space, like a knot in the system, and like we also invite everybody to come with us. There is no visas, or like visa is $10, and you can fill out the paperwork online. But yes, so if this is a time now, and if anybody, please share your thoughts with us. We really want to We want to hear how we can build this educational space together.
Thank you very much for this inspiring talk. The microphones should be open so we can all participate in a discussion with our speakers. Is there maybe already a question from the internet? All right, we have microphone one and microphone two. Please feel free to ask any kind of questions.
Maybe while we're waiting for the question, we can have, if you also turn the microphone, we can discuss more of how actually we can proceed building that and what will be in the visual assembly. So in East Africa, we just actually so going to purchase either piece of land or like building that needs renovation and start to build these educational spaces with public lectures that we're already hosting, exhibitions and a variety of other things. We also hope to get a license for 2 years master program. And we have a different ideas of how to fund the university so it wouldn't become the basically hedge fund that managing money and taking the fees from the students and then, you know, growing up this way or hunting for the grants. And the financial part is a big deal because you do want to have these learning spaces for free. It will be like really bizarre in the playground if in order to play you come and have to purchase the tickets. But it's a lot of open questions. How does it work? Also, how could it work? Also from the side of how to construct it.
Yeah, and I speaking as a person who's kind of coming from the hardware question, I'd almost say that's the least difficult or the least interesting part. in that, actually, what's really interesting is what would be the kind of software, if you like. What are the protocols of a space like this? And this is quite hard because we're all quite used to a very specific set of protocols. Even this room, is playing out one set of patterns. And so that's a kind of the interesting thing here is to also kind of open up. And there's so many interesting ideas out there about other what would be the protocols. What's the quid pro quo of spaces like that are openly invitational but have kind of protocols attached to how you engage with them.
Yeah. So when I was asked by the educational minister of Zanzibar what will be my ideal university that I want to build, I was thinking, I said, like, Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow, because that was open for all, it was free. They actually teach people something that they can use, like being an engineer or whatever else, and then come back to their own countries and do these things that they learn. But of course it was, part of this Cold War system, so we cannot replicate that. So we don't want to. So then we probably can build on that ideas, but should go somewhere else. And I think the crucial part is that it should be not the university, not the ideal university, but a part of the network of universities. And that's, in this way, hard way, is extremely important. Because when I'm telling people I want to build a university, like, the second question is, where do you get money? So how would you gonna fund it? So, yeah.
Are you ready for some questions from the public? Okay, microphone two, please.
On the slide about education, it mentioned that it was the ideal would be permissionless, but it mentioned but conditional. And I was just curious what some of the conditions would be. I figure something like respect or commitment to the process or something, but I didn't know what that was.
That's about software, yeah.
Like, yeah, exactly. That's exactly to the point of the software. And I don't know. It sounds like you also have some good ideas on this, but that's exactly what I was sort of driving at, right? Is it feels like, like there's so many amazing people in big organizations, in big universities, so I'm not slagging off universities, but a lot of people, when I speak to people who are in large organizational institutions, they're they tell similar versions of the same story, which is really hard to get into these gate-kept institutions. It costs a lot of money, you have to do interesting things. And then when you get in there, they seem to often engender, or certainly experience, a lot of really cruddy behaviours, honestly. And so there's a kind of interesting thing of how, if you were going to create models that can seriously disrupt a model like that and offer real value, it feels like, oddly enough, it would be the opposite. It would avoid costs. It would maximise openness. But as you say, actually, it's got to have protocols. It's got to have things about actually basic, like any form of online community, right? There are basic protocols of engagement. But that might go beyond just being respectful, right? It might go to do with, for example, whether work outputs are public goods or not, for example.
I just want to add that David was teaching in London School of Economics, and he was really hoping that if his book will do financially well, he can quit this job and work for the Open University, because he was saying 75% of students were Chinese who barely speak English, and they wanted to say something nice, but many of them he didn't understand. But the other thing he was saying, if you just start to do lectures online for free, very little group of people will join, because you actually need some of these rules. Otherwise, it would not be playful. So that's a crucial question: how to solve this problem.
Shall we quickly squeeze in your question before we're thrown out?
I wanted to ask, do you have any organization in East Africa that you are working with? Because I actually helped organize something similar with the Swahili Box in Mombasa, which is a hackerspace, and they run an open training for people in Mombasa. There's Global Innovation Gathering, even with people here, which is a network of spaces in the Global South, which is coordinating similar projects. So do you already have any partners on the ground who could help you and who know local culture?
So we are working now with Kibera Art District, mm-hmm. KAD. This is an existing organization in one of the biggest slums of the world in Nairobi. But we would love to connect to you, of course.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this wonderful talk and discussion. Our time has run out. Where can people find you, maybe later at the Congress or online for another questions or discussions?
DavidGraeber.org and WikiHouse.
If you're interested in WikiHouse, Google it. This is the easiest way.
Thank you very much.